This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Well, look who's having a moment.
Mark Cuban is here. He has been a capitalist his whole life, and he actually started with nothing and became a billionaire because of hard work and just smarts.
All right, Jeff Bezos' space company Blue Origin is teaming up with other aerospace giants for a successful trip to the moon.
It's another step toward Elon Musk's vision for a worldwide network of space-based internet.
Billionaires, you can't avoid them these days. It seems that three of them, if you can count Donald Trump, are running for president.
One of Democratic presidential candidate Tom Steyer's aides in Iowa has reportedly made contribution offers to local politicians in the hopes of securing endorsements for Steyer's presidential bid.
Michael Bloomberg, according to a top advisor, is preparing to enter the already crowded 2020 Democratic primary field.
Another billionaire reportedly giving him a little push, a little support. Recode is reporting that Amazon's Jeff Bezos called Bloomberg to personally urge him to run.
Meanwhile, two other candidates are making all billionaires the targets of their campaigns.
So tonight we say to Michael Bloomberg and other billionaires, sorry, you ain't gonna buy this election. Those days are gone.
Every budget, every policy that we talk about is about who's going to get opportunity. Is it going to go to the billionaires or is it going to go to our kids?
Celebrated or reviled, billionaires are dominating the national narrative in a way that seems so sudden and yet also eerily familiar.
In fact, this might be called the second Gilded Age, when you had huge wealth piled up at the very, very top, a lot of poverty, the middle class shrinking, and a great deal of government corruption.
Ah, that's it. Deja plutocrat, as Berkeley professor and former Secretary of Labor Robert Reich explains.
It's a very close parallel. Essentially, the very rich, the super rich robber barons of the 1880s, 1890s, the turn of the 20th century, they were celebrated by the establishment of that day. They were thought of as the entrepreneurs and great philanthropists of the era. But at the same time, they were monopolists. They were cutthroat in terms of how they got their money.
Likewise, Reich wrote this week, nowadays to make $1 billion does not signify mastery within a free market. It signifies unfair advantage in a highly rigged game.
We see again and again that, for example, anti-monopoly laws have not really been enforced. Antitrust is almost a dead letter. Insider trading has increased dramatically. We see that patents and trademarks and intellectual property rights have been expanded because a lot of people and a lot of big corporations have put a lot of money into politics to make sure that they've been expanded. According to economists Thomas Piketty and others who have researched this very carefully, about 60% is inherited now. The people who got it didn't get it out of their own work. They got it because they're living off of the work of previous generations. That was never part of the American dream.
And yet, here we seem to be. 1890 Redux, a society in which a handful of robber barons have captured our imaginations, and also an ungodly percentage of the world's wealth. It's like the measles, resurgence of a condition we'd thought we'd eradicated. After all, between 1900 and 1980, the structures of plutocracy were largely dismantled via legislation, unionization, taxation, muckraking journalism, the Great Depression, and, of course, the New Deal. This was FDR in 1936, espousing economic populism through vilification of the super rich.
And we know now that government by organized money is just as dangerous as government by organized mob.
Golly, that sounds familiar.
So here's the deal. You built a great fortune. Good for you. We're Americans. We want to make these investments. All we're saying is when you make it big, pitch in 2 cents so everybody else gets a chance to make it.
I'm Elizabeth Warren, and I approve this message.
Oddly, the plutocracy did not approve that message.
I mean, I can't use an expletive, right?
Hedge fund billionaire Leon Cooperman, like Mark Cuban, JPMorgan Chase's Jamie Dimon, and ex-Goldman Sachs CEO Lloyd Blankfein, squealed at the unfairness of it all.
It's complete bull. She's screwing around with the wrong guy because basically I want to give it all away. Not 50, 60%. I want to give it all away, but I want to control the decision. I don't need the government giving away my money. And the idea of vilifying wealthy people is so bogus. You know, they're appealing to the masses.
Speaking of which, Fox and Friends.
Another finance billionaire calling out Elizabeth Warren over her wealth tax proposal.
I was surprised that so many rich people were almost kind of quiet when they're attacked. Not this time.
Not this time.
Even the world's most famous philanthropist, Bill Gates, recently joined the billionaire cohort in resisting ambitious wealth tax plans from the Democratic left flank. Here he was speaking last week with Andrew Ross Sorkin in front of a live audience.
And I do think if you tax too much, you do risk the capital formation, innovation. U.S. is the desirable place to do innovative companies. I do think you risk that.
It happens that economic history doesn't support that conclusion. But Gates' position takes on an outsized influence, not necessarily because of special expertise, but because of another disproportionate effect of riches, what journalists Jamel Bowie and Anand Giridharadas call the billionaire veto. Robert Reich.
The billionaire class is powerful not just because they donate a lot of money to political candidates and they do a lot of lobbying. They're also powerful because they have a huge amount of influence over public opinion and over the not. It's a chilling effect on not-for-profits, on universities, on inquiry. So there is that kind of a veto.
Gates, arguably more than anyone else on Earth, has the capacity to influence human priorities. And with every philanthropic effort to further cement his reputation not as a robber baron, but as a humanitarian.
Bill wondered what it would take to reimagine both toilets and sewage systems.
What if you can fund inventors that could come up with something that's a tenth the cost? You know, that's pretty magical, and you end up saving millions of lives.
Gates' philanthropic work is the main subject of a new three-part Netflix documentary titled Inside Bill's Brain. Directed by Davis Guggenheim of An Inconvenient Truth fame, the film documents Gates' journey from tech titan to prolific do-gooder. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has carefully invested Microsoft billions into life-saving public health initiatives targeting polio, malaria, and other preventable diseases. Oh, and also, he told Sorkin,
you know, I've paid over $10 billion in taxes. I paid more than anyone in taxes. I'm glad to have paid.
But were those billions ever rightfully his to begin with? In the new book, Goliath, The 100-Year War Between Monopoly Power and Democracy, Matt Stoller chronicles the predatory tactics that both enriched Bill Gates and landed him in federal court. Matt, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
If you'll permit me to stipulate that Bill Gates can be both a monopolist bully and an astonishingly brilliant and hands-on philanthropist, can we please turn our attention to the bully part? Gates' fortune was not solely the result of building a better mousetrap, eh?
Right. So Bill Gates is obviously a very smart guy, and he's a very good businessman. But the reason he made $100 billion instead of $20 million or $50 million is purely because of public policy changes that enabled monopolistic behavior. Copyright changes in 1976 and 1980 allow the copywriting of software. There was also a significant set of antitrust suits in the 1970s, one of which was against IBM, and one of the suppliers that it used for the new personal computer was Microsoft, and they allowed Microsoft to sell that operating system to other personal computer makers. It was very unlike how IBM operated, but they did it because the DOJ scared them. And then the DOJ dropped the suit in 1982 and essentially stopped enforcing antitrust law. So Bill Gates used a host of anti-competitive tactics that created the last generation of robber barons in the late 19th century, early 20th century, to monopolize the key on-ramp to the most important and fastest-growing industry in human history up to that point, which was personal computers and that new software industry.
So behind the floppy bangs and the oversized glasses, Gates just went all robber baron on the world. In the Gilded Age of the late 19th century, there were the likes of Andrew Carnegie, Cornelius Vanderbilt, and John D. Rockefeller to run roughshod on the marketplace. You think Bill Gates was a sort of reincarnation of John D. Rockefeller?
Yeah, that's right. John D. Rockefeller was an oil refiner, and so he essentially made a pact with other oil refiners, and he basically accumulated a lot of shipping power. So he went to the railroads, and he said, if a competitor actually ships on your railroad, then you have to give me a rebate for every barrel of oil that they ship. And he had so much buying power that the railroads had to say yes. And then he would go to his competitors and he would say, you can't succeed here, so sell out to me. And then he was able to essentially monopolize all oil refining. But it wasn't because he was a better oil refiner. It's because he used market power to demand better pricing terms from railroads who became dependent on him. And he was able to control the entire industry. And that's very much what Bill Gates did with operating systems. So Bill Gates said to computer makers, I'll give you a certain licensing fee if you put Microsoft operating systems, DOS, and then Windows. But then I'm going to change that fee if you build computers with other operating systems. So effectively, you have to give me a rebate if you use any of my competitors' products. And you just can't compete with that. So then he just rolled up the whole operating system market.
That's a silver or lead proposition.
Yeah, that's right. It's like the drug dealer, you know, says you can get bribed or you can get a bullet, right? I mean, it's not that violent. He was then able to effectively dislodge Lotus 1-2-3, which controlled spreadsheets, and then I believe it was WordPerfect that controlled word processing, and replaced them with what became Microsoft Word and Microsoft Excel. What you always see with monopolists who control an important platform, they use their control of that platform to take control of markets that have to live on that platform.
But at this stage, the revolution of personal computing is about to lead into a second revolution of the internet. What did Gates do?
So the most dangerous time for a monopolist is when they have a monopoly over an existing marketplace, and then there's some technological inflection point that changes the marketplace. For example, Google had desktop search control, and then there was a shift to mobile. And that was the moment when there was an opportunity for new entrants. All of a sudden, people were going to use this new thing called the internet, this new technology called the browser, which is controlled by a company called Netscape, could effectively replace or commoditize the operating system. So Bill Gates saw this and he said, that's a really dangerous thing. We need to control this new on-ramp to this marketplace that could be even bigger than the personal computer, which is the internet. So he built his own browser, which was Internet Explorer, and started bundling it with Windows and started making deals, making it harder and harder for Netscape to get onto computers and easier for Internet Explorer to get onto computers. Towards the late 1990s, and this is in a book by Gary Reback, who was a lawyer that opposed Microsoft, Microsoft called together a whole bunch of venture capitalists. And they said, look, there's this new incredible thing called the internet. Here are the places that we're going to invest. And here are the places that you're going to be allowed to invest. It was a little bit more subtle than that, but that was sort of the gist of it.
All right. But in the film, speaking to Guggenheim, Gates just shrugs that off.
A reasonable person might think you had a monopoly?
If monopoly means extremely high market share with short-term market power, the answer is yes. If it means that we had an unchallengeable position where new and better technology didn't have a chance to replace us, the answer is no.
Well, that's an answer. Antitrust regulators had a slightly different definition of monopoly, more along the lines of strong-arming. And in that case, Gates' sense of impunity served him poorly. In the antitrust trial, prosecutors cherry-picked some video from Gates's deposition and played it at trial to make him look like an arrogant smartass.
I have no idea what you're talking about when you say ask.
Do you want me to define proprietary API or
no? I don't want you to define proprietary API.
Do you believe that the publication of that statement affected Netscape? Like hurt their feelings? Somebody cried or...
In the movie, Gates claims that the video gambit was unfair and prejudicial.
A certain sense of arrogance came through that hurt us quite a bit. It shouldn't have hurt us because that's not what was on trial. It turned out, though, it was part of what was on trial.
And were you arrogant?
In a certain sense, people who make billions of dollars in their 20s and manage, you know, thousands of people and decide which products they're going to do and not do, yes, that can appear to be quite arrogant.
That is quite an answer, Matt. You know, one could perhaps argue self-indicting.
These monopolists are autocrats. Bill Gates is mentored Mark Zuckerberg. Mark Zuckerberg is an autocrat. One of the reasons that we have to encourage and force competition in markets and not allow anti-competitive behavior is because when you do, then you get these people who are autocrats who accumulate large amounts of power and money and then use that to enforce a social vision on society. And that's what we see with Bill Gates, but it's also what we see now increasingly everywhere, corrupting our politics, corrupting global politics. The arrogance that was on display at that trial, it was real arrogance, but it was also a function of the fact that our public policy framework in the 1980s allowed Bill Gates to be extraordinarily greedy and thuggish.
All right, so a year later came the verdict.
A federal judge found that Microsoft was a monopoly that uses its power to stifle competition at the expense of consumers.
The district court judge, the remedy that he chose was to split up the company. We're going to split you up into an operating system and then everything else. That remedy was overturned by an appeals court.
Microsoft was vindicated on all these counts. And then I just started crying.
When Bill Gates says we were vindicated, they're lying. The original decision that Microsoft was a monopolist that had abused its monopoly power was not overturned. They just changed the remedy. To me, when I look at this, I just think it's all so crazy, is that the remedy of just splitting up the company was so insanely mild. The Sherman Act is a criminal statute. It also says that if you monopolize, you get fined three times the amount that you got from monopolization. Because monopolization is a crime of theft. You're taking other people's property when you use anti-competitive behavior. So it should have been split up, and I think it would have been a better company. But he shouldn't have a fortune. You know, they should have put a $150 billion fine because the property that he got, he stole it from other people using anti-competitive tactics. And he held back the development of technology by forcing everyone to use Windows, which was not as good as it could have been if there had actually been competition.
So no gigantic confiscatory fines. But then
there was one really positive impact of the case. You know, it oxygenated the market. Charles Duhigg at the New York Times did a story talking to former Microsoft executives who said, we were thinking of killing this young company called Google through our control of the browser, but we didn't do that because we were afraid of antitrust actions. It got Microsoft to stop acting like a bully and allowed a flowering of innovation in the early to mid-2000s that allowed for a lot of great companies to form. And Microsoft did not end up capturing social media, didn't end up capturing email or search or shopping or a whole bunch of things that I think it probably would have been able to capture if it hadn't been restrained, just like IBM was not able to capture the personal computer market because it was restrained by antitrust law.
So in the year 2000, this chastened Bill Gates with his wife Melinda started the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which has spent billions of dollars undertaking philanthropic works, mostly in public health, mostly in Africa. But you believe that decisions on how to spend those dollars, which had they been paid in taxes and slashed under the Sherman Antitrust Act of 1890, would have been in the hands of governments, not a private foundation. And you think this kind of redistribution of wealth by one titan is inherently anti-democratic?
Yeah, so if somebody, and I'm not saying this is Gates, but I'm just giving an analogy, right? It's like if somebody robbed a lot of banks and then gave some money to charity. It's not a substitute for government. It's competition with government. You know, the idea of building a new toilet to, you know, help Senegalese children is a good thing. But I'll give you an alternative example of how we used to do this kind of thing. So one of the things that Franklin Delano Roosevelt and our democratic government did in the 1930s is just build a lot of toilets. A lot of places in this country did not have indoor plumbing. We had very bad sanitation systems, and the government improved people's lives dramatically through aggressive sanitation measures. Public systems do this extraordinarily well if they're well run. When I look at the Gates Foundation, I see a failure of public health infrastructure, of a kind of libertarian philosophy, which says just place power in the hands of private actors and then they can solve our social problems, because they clearly can't. FDR in 1938 said, weak democracies produce dictatorship. If you have a weak democracy, which we've had really since the late 1970s, a democracy where our officials defer to private concentrations of power, then you're going to be governed by someone like Bill Gates. And people are going to look up to people like Bill Gates because they've lost the confidence that we, the people, can do these things, because we, the people, have not done them for a while.
Matt, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Matt Stoller is the author of Goliath, the 100-year war between monopoly power and democracy. That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Alana Casanova Burgess, Michael Loewinger, Leah Feder, John Hanrahan, and Asa Chattavetti. We had more help from Charlotte Gartenberg, and our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Sam Baer and Josh Hahn.
Pat Hill Rogers is our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.